Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty's got the day off today. We're going to spend the next hour looking at the affordable housing situation in Philadelphia and the nation. What is available to the low and moderate income families looking to buy or rent homes and apartments in the city? And how is Philadelphia looking to grow opportunities for safe and affordable housing? On April 11th, the 50th anniversary of the enactment of the Federal Fair Housing Act, City Council unveiled a package of affordable housing bills called Putting Philadelphians First. The legislation includes a new and somewhat controversial construction tax and new bonuses for inclusionary housing. We'll talk about what all that means. And if approved, what might this mean for families who are struggling to find good, affordable housing in the Philadelphia area? We'll talk about this and much more this hour. We're joined by Beth McConnell, Policy Director for the Philadelphia Association of Community Development Corporations. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times, Beth.
Good morning, Mary. Thanks for having me.
And David Feldman is Executive Director of the Development Workshop and more. Hello, David, and welcome to Radio Times.
Good morning, Mary. Thank you so much.
Sure. Here's the number to jump into the conversation if you'd like to, if you're at home or in the car or perhaps at work, 888-477-9499. You can also send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So let's begin by talking about who is most in need of affordable housing in the Philadelphia region right now, May of 2018. Can you help us put a face to this story, Beth? Are we talking young families, elderly families? Where in the city? What do incomes look like?
Sure. All of the above. In fact, here in Philadelphia, we have over 70,000 extremely low-income households that are paying an extremely high percentage of their incomes every month on rent. Such a high percentage that it makes it very difficult for them to afford other basic necessities. And they're one emergency or one missed work day, one asthma attack away from potentially losing their housing. And that includes senior citizens. It includes families. It includes persons with physical disabilities and challenges. And so it's really in our best interest as a city to make sure that we're providing as many affordable housing units to that population as possible. In terms of income limits, where we have the most need are families and households earning under 30% area median income, which for a family of four is, forgive me, I won't know the number exactly off the top of my head, but roughly $40,000 a year for a family of four.
Mm-hmm. What are the distinguishing factors, if any, between people in need of affordable housing who are homeowners, who would like to be homeowners, and people who are renters?
So for folks that are looking to buy a home, either become a first-time home buyer or trade up, certainly in our downtown core neighborhoods and in the areas that surrounding it, it's getting harder and harder to be able to afford a home. There's a pretty significant number of families in Philadelphia that earn under $38,000 a year. That's, I think more than half of the city earns less than that. So to be able to buy new construction homes or even some of the older row homes in some of the neighborhoods in South Philadelphia or north of the city, it's getting really hard for them to be able to come up down payments as well as closing costs, let alone get qualified for a mortgage.
So overall, characterize the available housing stock for affordable housing in Philadelphia.
If you're looking to rent an affordable unit, you need an awful lot of luck. Typically, when an affordable rental unit becomes available, there are 12 applications for every single unit. Waiting lists are years long. In fact, the Philadelphia Housing Authority, which is a whole other conversation, that's a very big entity, they've closed their waiting list. And so you can't even get on it any longer. We have virtually eliminated funding for affordable homeownership development in Philadelphia because of federal budget cuts. But because of the proposal that's being put forward in council right now, there's an opportunity to potentially restart ownership, affordable homeownership, invest more in affordable rental, and give some help to those moderate income home buyers to get into an existing property with a little assistance.
And we'll get to that proposal in just a moment.
So David? This is where I need to jump in with one of my other hats, because as the executive director of the Development Workshop is one of my roles.
Okay.
Also, I teach housing policy at Temple University's Community Development Program, and I work as a realtor working with first-time home buyers. So, I think everything Beth said is true, and I've had a couple of home buyers in the last year who have been first-time home buyers who got homes that had FHA mortgages that were in perfect moving condition for $75,000, one at 53rd and Girard, one at Frankfurt and Clearfield. Both of those are near transportation. Both were older houses that will have elements of fix up over the year. And as far as the home ownership, it's true. We're lucky that we have such a high home ownership rate. Mm-hmm. We're over 50%, but our home ownership rate has dropped 8% in the last 10 years.
Why is that?
Well, there's a 2014 Pew study. We had a big hit from the foreclosure crisis, and with the tightening requirements, it was harder for people to buy homes. That's loosened up a lot in the last 2 years. People are able to we're seeing people being able to return to the market. Our home ownership profile is kind of interesting from this Pew report. About 40% of our homeowners own their homes free and clear. A lot of those are seniors. A lot of those are low-income folks who have difficulty with home repair costs. And 37.5% of our homeowners, as Beth said, are low-income. They make $35,000 or less a year. They have issues clearly with maintenance. The one other point I want to make, because we talked about getting new units, building a new unit of affordable housing in a city like Philadelphia is the most expensive and the least effective way to help people.
Why?
For the $350,000 or more that any CDC takes to build a house because of a lot of regulations that happen with official affordable housing, you could give 100 low-income households a $300 a month rental voucher for the full year of their lease. Hmm. So 100 low-income tenants, which is probably where a lot more of the pain is, given our poverty rate and a lot more of the 48% who rent are low-income than homeowners are low-income, that could help keep people in their homes. 80 to 85% of all evictions are for lack of payment, which means the real problem with eviction is people don't have enough money to pay the rent.
So we are talking about the legislation before council that talks about building more affordable housing. And we're going to get to that in just a moment. But, David, I wanted to talk about this pending and extensive study of housing in Philadelphia, which is supposed to parse needs and propose solutions. Give us a little insight into this study that's happening right now, what we're supposed to learn from it. And also, you say it might be jumping the gun to introduce legislation before we know what comes of this study.
I think it is. I think we have had a couple of programs we put in place. We increased the real estate transfer tax 2 years ago, and over half that money hasn't been spent yet. We're waiting for reports from the Affordable Housing Trust Fund to find out what they do that's more effective and less effective.
And that report came out yesterday.
Ah, oh, did? Okay. Congratulations.
Fill us in.
Go.
Oh, okay. We know there are a lot of needs. We're a really complex market. Some people talk of us being a tale of two cities, where three-quarters of our population live in a really affordable major city and a quarter of our population lives in poverty. I think there's probably even more layers to that in terms of who has access to transit, what are our middle markets, the working-class solid neighborhoods where we hope more families stay. We have to look at the schools, transit, neighborhood safety, so that a lot of our existing neighborhoods have been great places to live, the kinds of places where Beth and my family lived for a couple generations, can still be places that people want to stay, live, raise their families, age in place.
Philly's complex, though, and this is why we haven't moved perhaps forward as fast as we could have in providing affordable housing.
Yeah, and I want to come back to one point that David made about how expensive it is to build new construction affordable homes, and he's right. The reason why is because most of the money that we have to build affordable housing is our federal funds, and we're subject to federal rules and requirements that make it very difficult and take a number of years to build affordable homes. But building affordable housing is not just about putting a roof over somebody's head. It's also about revitalizing and transforming entire neighborhoods that are saddled with vacancy and blight. And rather than leave an empty lot there that is a target for short dumping and illegal activity, we are able to use those federal resources that are oftentimes restricted. We can't use it for whatever we want. We have to use it to do new construction or significant rehab of affordable homes. We can't necessarily use it for the voucher program that David suggested.
Are federal resources drying up?
And federal resources have been cut dramatically. So here in Philadelphia, one program in particular that I'll talk about, the Community Development Block Grant Program, if our allocation had kept pace with inflation from the early 1990s to today, we'd be getting more than $125 million a year in funding. Instead, we're getting about less than $40 million a year in funding. So that's meant the city has had to cut programs like affordable home ownership development. It means there's less resources available to fill gaps, so there are projects that don't happen. I say all that because I think it's really important. We can continue to push at the federal level. We can continue to call for changes to federal programs. But what's really important is local leadership, to look at the resources that we have available in our city today and how we can reinvest them, particularly flexible resources that we have more ability to control how we spend them and where we spend them.
All right, let's take a look at what.
And I think I'm exactly in agreement with that last statement.
Okay. Let's take a look at what Philadelphia City Council will be considering in the very near future. The legislative effort, again, is called Putting Philadelphia First. It includes a 1% tax on the cost of construction projects, which benefit from the 10-year abatement on property taxes. So refresh us here. Which projects are we talking about? What benefits from that abatement?
Here's the real question. So there's a four-page brochure that the council president issued putting Philadelphia First. There's three paragraphs in it that talk about where $22 million a year will go. Three paragraphs.
And this is from the construction tax that they envision enacting.
This is how he introduced the bill.
Okay.
And it's what he handed out to introduce the bill. And three paragraphs with no details about where this is going to be placed, how many units, what the division of use is. Currently, there are over $22 million a year paid in real estate and development taxes and fees that go directly to affordable housing programs. They go to the Affordable Housing Trust Fund, and they go to the funds from the real estate transfer tax are supposed to go to home repair programs. I'm glad we got a report today. It's been 3 years since we've seen a report. The latest tax increase that happened 2 years ago, 60% of it was going to three existing programs, which is a wonderful thing, and we're glad it's happening. We don't know how much of that 60% has actually been spent, how many additional homes have been helped. The other 40%, 2 years down the road, still doesn't have a program that anyone can apply to and have someone show up at their house with a hammer. So what we're saying is, why are you putting a third tax in place on three paragraphs of text? Come with a plan and tell us how much you need and where it's going and who's going to help.
Beth McConnell, do you see it this way, that there's confusion as to where funding is going, and we've got this $22 million that might come into the Housing Trust Fund should this 1% construction tax be approved?
I do believe that the construction tax should be approved, and I respectfully disagree with my colleague David about what we know about how existing affordable housing resources have been spent. As David referred to a few years ago, under the leadership of the council president and councilwoman Sherelle Parker, and with the support of most members of council, the 1% increase in the real estate transfer tax was adopted, and $60 million of that is going to eliminate an existing waiting list for an existing program that has been on the books, that has been operational, has been quite successful, and we're about 2 years into spending down those funds. Homes are being repaired, and families are finding that they have safer, healthier places to live in because of that program. We also, every year, do a pretty exhaustive plan. It's called the Consolidated Plan of how we're going to leverage all of our existing resources in the service of affordable housing and community development. There is stakeholder input. There are city council hearings. We also just went through a federal process called the Assessment of Fair Housing, where there were 43 recommendations. We have a lot of ideas. What we need is money.
Okay. We're going to talk some more about that 1% construction tax that has been proposed, the pros and the cons, in just a moment, as we take a close look at the availability of affordable housing in the city of Philadelphia. Our guests, David Feldman, Executive Director of the Development Workshop, Beth McConnell, Policy Director of Philadelphia Association of Community Development Corporations. This is Radio Times. Stay with us. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty Moskowain is off today. Our guests include Beth McConnell, Policy Director at Philadelphia Association of Community Development Corporations. David Feldman is Executive Director of the Development Workshop, among other things. And the number to call is 888-477-9499 if you'd like to get into the conversation. We are focusing on what Philadelphia City Council is doing, is considering in new proposals aimed at easing the affordable housing burden. We went into the break talking about a proposed 1% tax, a new tax on certain construction in the city of Philadelphia. Critics say you have this, you have a real estate transfer tax, you have the increase, you also have a proposed increase in property taxes from Mayor Kenney. Is this a negative when it comes to businesses and jobs looking to relocate to the city? I mean, we've got Amazon. We're still on the short list in Philly for Amazon. Is this a disincentive?
And don't forget that as the three of us are sitting here, City Council's having a meeting for a bill that Councilwoman Blackwell's proposed to increase the parking requirements in new construction, which adds to the cost of all construction, including affordable housing.
David and I agree on this point.
We do. And actually, on the real estate transfer tax from 2 years ago, I just want to remind people, the development workshop actually testified in council in favor of the increase. You know, we saw that the uses
but
were good,
altogether.
But we haven't seen the reporting from it. But altogether, cumulatively, Jones Lang LaSalle testified in city council a couple of weeks ago. They're a national consulting firm about real estate trends, and they also consult to investors, national investing and banks, who are looking at markets in every city, all the cities we're competing with. And they said, you know, the lack of predictability, the fact that there's been a rash of bills about, you know, plumbing codes and the parking requirements and inclusionary zoning and a new tax on construction, as opposed to the administration coming out with a report, hopefully in the fall, that will say this is where the needs are and that everyone can come together and you know, have agreement of what it's going to look like for someone to come from Los Angeles or Atlanta. Southern Land is building a Rittenhouse Square. Mm-hmm. They had to decide, is Philadelphia a market they want to come to and invest their money?
Are these a disincentive?
Well, we can't have the conversation about disincentives to building without talking about the 10-year tax abatement, which is a massive subsidy and incentive.
Yes.
Since 2000, every single new construction or significant rehab is being heavily subsidized by the public, and this includes
low and moderate income
people, and this includes skyscrapers, multi-million dollar condos, and you know, more moderate income properties. But the massive benefit in terms of the total dollar value accrues to higher income developments and people. We've been subsidizing
which is where most money is spent.
Hang on one second.
So it's proportional.
So we've been subsidizing these projects for the last 18 years. And for listeners that aren't familiar, basically the either the owner of the property, if it's rental or ownership, they only pay taxes on the value of the property before it was improved. So if it was a vacant lot and they built a new skyscraper on it, they only pay taxes on the value of the vacant lot for 10 years. That's a big subsidy. It's time for the low and moderate income people that subsidize that program to get something back in return in the form of affordable homes.
So speaking of timing,
so that's $22 million into the housing trust fund from this tax.
Right. And speaking of timing, so the abatement's been in place for 17 years, which means there's 7 years of expired abatements. This year, there's $87 million in additional tax revenue that comes from the properties whose 10-year tax abatements have expired. Many of those properties would not have been built if we didn't have it. So the city has this ongoing in perpetuity increase in a real estate tax base, that 87 this year, and that's going to increase every year. You know, by another 10 years, it's going to be $126 million.
None of that revenue gets directed to affordable housing.
Okay. So let's move forward.
And that's a city council budget decision. They could easily do that.
And back to what's before Philadelphia City Council. Councilwoman Maria Quiñones Sanchez, her proposal for mandatory inclusionary zoning has changed somewhat since its inception. It's now a mixed income housing bill. And essentially, Beth, my understanding is this sets aside a portion of new affordable housing units. Their bonuses are given to developers if they build a certain way. They're allowed to exclude, to get out of zoning rules, build higher, build denser, if they include affordable housing. Tell me what you think about this.
Yeah, so basically developers would be able to buy a density bonus with a commitment that they either provide an affordable unit on site to a low or moderate income family or individual, or pay a fee into the housing trust fund that would be used to provide affordable housing in a variety of different ways. This is a policy. It's often called inclusionary zoning. It's in place in more than 800 jurisdictions across the country. Most other places are mandatory. Councilwoman Sanchez is proposing now modifying her bill to be a voluntary density bonus program. And I think it's a real question for our city and for our neighbors of whether we're willing to accept a little extra density in return for attacking inequality and segregation and giving every family in Philadelphia an opportunity to live in a great neighborhood in a safe, affordable home, and which I think has spillover effects to improve our entire communities.
When I think denser and higher, though, I for some reason, reason that, you know, it, some negatives pop to mind, because the trend has been toward more green space, more open space. It's healthier mentally, physically. Kids get to ride their bikes perhaps a little bit, you know, or you know, have places to play.
Sure.
Is it necessarily a good thing to build denser and higher, even if you're providing more homes? So let me let Beth in, and then Deb, you can get
it. So first, I think it's important to know we do have a zoning code that has limits on height and density, and we're not talking about taking a skyscraper that you would find in Center City and putting it in a row house neighborhood.
Okay.
We're talking about, you know, maybe an extra floor or two for some of the kind of less dense neighborhoods, maybe a little bit more in Center City or areas where we have an awful lot of density already. So I know that there is some concern from some neighbors. They're worried that you're going to see, you know, big, huge buildings popping up next to the row homes. But I think the bonuses that are being offered are not going to radically alter the base zoning districts that we have in the city, but it will allow for a little extra density. And I know people have some concern about that. Again, I would come back to whether it's worth it for more affordable homes.
So I have great sympathy for Councilwoman Kanuna Sanchez. She came to speak to my housing policy class, and you know, she's entered into the third rail of neighborhood zoning battles. I wanted to bring up, you know, kind of how difficult this is. There's three small neighborhood-based developers who have been doing the equivalent of inclusionary zoning. They've been including affordable units in their market rate development without using this bonus, without any public subsidy. Like mentioning SPAC Group, M&M Partners, Mosaic Development Corporation, which is a minority female-owned firm. Two of those three had applied for zoning variances in, you know, I'd say edge greater city, Center City neighborhoods to have more units than the current zoning allows, an existing adaptive reuse of existing buildings. So they're not building any higher, but they wanted to put more smaller units and include affordable as part of them. One was going to be all affordable, and their respective council people would not allow the zoning variances for the additional units. And in one case, there are fewer units, they're larger, they're all market rate, there's no affordable because of the council person wouldn't allow the zoning variance. In the other case, the project still stalled because the numbers don't work for her project unless she can get more units and then she can make them affordable.
So we need 9 thumbs up votes on council for anything to pass. So what is your sense? Are you hearing about, you know, what reaction there might be to Quiñones Sanchez's mixed housing bill? Hearing anything, Beth?
I think
I'd hate to predict what the votes will look like, because I would probably be proven wrong. But there's been significant amount of debate over this policy since June. There were many members of council and their staff involved in that and helping shape the proposal. The bill was moved out of committee but heavily amended. But I really think we have to look at it as part of the package of the construction impact tax and the Putting Philadelphians First package as a whole package of ways that we're going to again, attack residential economic segregation and give more low and moderate income Philadelphians that have been in the city their whole lives, that are the folks that drive our buses and serve our food and work in our retail offices, the same opportunities to live in great neighborhoods as everyone else.
So the real problem about making inclusionary zoning work, unfortunately, in Philadelphia is the cost of construction in Philadelphia and getting projects, like I said, Mosaic Development in a fringe neighborhood couldn't make the numbers work if they couldn't put, you know, more units in. Concordia Development Group is a group from Washington, D.C. that testified in council a few weeks ago. They're building 91 market-rate townhouses in Pennsport that are basically identical to a project that they're doing in northeast Washington, D.C. And their testimony, they've been shocked, it's the first project here, that it's taken 8 months to build a house that takes 5 to 6 in Washington, D.C., and it's costing them 30% more than it costs to build the same house in Washington, D.C. And no one would say Washington, D.C. is a cheap place to build. So there are real cost problems that make it much more difficult to make the numbers work with inclusionary housing. The Lincoln Institute did a study 2 years ago on inclusionary zoning, and it was authored by a former colleague, Mike Lisks, who's out in the Bay Area, where they have a lot of inclusionary zoning and a very different market. And I asked him, I said, this is a great report. It's 65 pages. You have a lot of examples. Not one of them is a Rust Belt or what we call legacy city. Mm-hmm. I said, why didn't you give any examples from those cities? And he's like, oh, well, the economics don't work in those cities.
Beth, I'd like to get your perspective on that. Yeah. The whatever it is, it's taking so much longer in the Philadelphia area. imagine you're frustrated with that, and what are some of the answers?
Yeah, so I want to come back to David's point about the Philadelphia market. We are a mixed market city. For sure, we have neighborhoods that are not seeing new development, where rents are low, and where it's hard to actually build new construction and sell it at a price that you can recoup.
Agreed.
That's why community development matters so much, and why using federal resources to invest in those places matters. But you cannot walk downtown right now and in some of our neighborhoods without having to cross the street four or five times to avoid all of the construction that's happening. We have seen some of the most expensive condos in the history of the city recently built and sold. So our downtown and some of the surrounding cores, that's simply not true. They can build. They can build to a very high end of the market and do so profitably. The question now is whether we can leverage some of those resources mm-hmm. in the service of the neighborhoods and the communities that are being left behind.
David?
So in the last 10 years, there have been exactly two brand new high-rise condo buildings in Center City during one of the hottest housing booms we've had. Yes, I hate crossing.
And 4,000 new units of rental in 1 year alone.
Right. So 4,000 new units, 100 of which were high-end condos. So that's 2% of what got built downtown.
And so Beth, is that – what is your perspective
on that? It's bad optics, but you know, it's great that we're having a better market than we had for 50 years, but if you compare us to other cities – We're nowhere near as good.
Let me get to some of our callers. We have a tweet that says affordable housing is a buzzword based on average income. What is needed is low income housing. Are we talking semantics here, Beth?
No, I think the it's an important point that the greatest need for affordable homes is for our lowest income neighbors, people 30%, 20% area median income and below. Those are projects that need heavy amounts of public subsidy to make them work. And I think part of the putting Philadelphia first in the construction impact tax is to begin to raise some additional revenue that we can invest in more projects to serve those communities. And I think that's important. I think City Council should prioritize that. I think they should also make some of the resources available for affordable home ownership development that might help some of the upper income folks. But we have been pushing that they set aside at least half for the lowest income Philadelphians. That's where we have the greatest need and where the resources would go the furthest.
A place where Beth and I would be in complete agreement.
Oh, good. All right. Licenses and Inspections Commissioner David Perry wants to rewrite Philadelphia's zoning code to allow more rooming housing or boarding houses in residential neighborhoods, which don't allow it at this point. Perry says there are a lot of illegal properties operating right now. If they were legalized and regulated, it would be a lot easier to keep tabs on safety, and you'd have more houses available, more homes, more rooms, rather, available to people who are on the low-income scale.
Sounds like my great-grandparents' first home in Strawberry Mansion.
And it was done probably to a great extent generations ago. But, Beth, what do you think is moving forward with the affordable housing issue?
You know, I saw Commissioner Perry's proposal, and I've read some of the articles, actually, in Plan Philly here at WHYY. I can't say that we, as an organization, have looked into it very deeply to know what the right balance is between ensuring that we respect the zoning laws and the needs of the neighbors we're also serving that.
David, any thoughts?
Again, you hit the third rail of neighborhood zoning not on my block. But it's happening anyway. So wouldn't a well-regulated, licensed
– yeah.
I mean, every home I've ever lived, the first thing I did was put in hardwired smoke detectors, which is one of the bills that's out there.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
If we don't know where rooming houses are, we don't know if they have hardwired smoke detectors.
But otherwise, you don't see this moving forward at this moment on a full-scale basis.
I haven't seen a proposal on City Council yet. Yeah.
So. I think it's a heavy political lift.
Okay.
Again, we agree.
Let's talk a little bit about gentrification. The Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia released a study recently, which actually showed that the loss of homes in gentrifying areas owned by low and moderate income families has been relatively small.
Only a 4% difference than in non-gentrifying neighborhoods. I'd like to make a rare statement, and I think City Council did something really well.
Let's hope Daryl Clark is listening, David.
I think I can say that about more things. But first time in this show, I'm going to say City Council did something really well. They put in strong, effective, and broad protections for long-time and low-income homeowners, and they are extending the period of those protections. They're necessary, they're the right move, and we're glad they did it.
But this does not entail the group of people who need affordable housing who rent.
Right. So when neighborhoods are gentrifying, as we know, when home prices and rents go up, the first people to move are renters. And it is hard to find out what happens to them because of the kind of data that's available. There's very high mobility among low-income renters already. The Federal Reserve of Philadelphia has really done some excellent research, several reports on this topic to try to better understand it, and more work's needed. But I think, again, where David and I agree, Philadelphia City Council has taken this very seriously. They've put policies in place that protect homeowners, but we need more for renters. And I think part of raising additional resources is to build affordable homes in every neighborhood, including those that are gentrifying, so that low-income renters have an opportunity to stay in those places or choose those places.
Well, again, we're a city that has three-quarters of the population it had before. So while we've torn down a lot of stuff, we've also built stuff. Unlike cities that are growing that didn't, you know, that had a lot fewer people, so they don't have enough housing units of whatever quality, like Seattle or Portland or Austin or Denver, which is why they're not good examples to look at. We have a large housing – we have enough housing stock. A lot of it's in poor quality. So, you know, as opposed – again, I get back to building a brand new unit of housing just from a financial point. And I take Beth's earlier points about building neighborhoods, but from a financial point you know, there are better places to spend $350,000. We can help more people by working with the existing housing stock we have, with potentially a locally based rent voucher, because we're not getting any more federal rent vouchers.
We've only got about a minute left. Beth?
Just in, and again, another report from the Federal Reserve showed that Philadelphia actually lost 23,000 units of affordable homes from the year 2000 to 2014 because they either went market rate or their subsidies expired. Mm. You know, to make resources available to keep those homes affordable so we're not losing affordable homes in the housing stock should also be a priority and something that we've urged council to do with some of the new resources that will be generated from the construction tax.
Okay, but so that quickly, wasn't part of the council president's bill. That's not part of his proposal.
Okay. We hope it becomes part.
As we wrap up, putting Philadelphians first, should this pass muster before Philadelphia City Council, how much affordable housing would you like to see created out of this bill?
Well,
how many families could find homes?
That's an excellent question. Unfortunately, we'll still only be a drop in the bucket of the need for affordable homes. And these resources will be blended with other sources of funding from the state and federal resources. So it's hard to predict exactly how many units just yet. But we hope it's enough to make a meaningful impact on low-income families.
David, we've got 10 seconds for any last thoughts.
We're looking forward for the study that LISC is going to do for the city over the summer so we can bring together private and nonprofit developers to come with solutions to get more people in better homes for lower cost.
Okay, David Feldman is with the Development Workshop. Beth McCollum, Policy Director of Philadelphia Association of Community Development Corporations, thanks so much for coming in to our studios.
Thank you,
Mary. Radio Times, we appreciate it.
Thanks.
All right. The National Perspective is coming up right after the break. Keep it here. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings. Jordan Kristen Capps is staff writer at the Atlantic's City Lab, and he joins us now to talk about the affordable housing picture on the national scene. Hi, Kristen.
Hi. How are you?
Good, thanks. So let's first talk about funding at the federal level and President Trump's proposed budget for 2019. A short while back, you wrote that if the budget were to pass, it would pose unimaginable hardship for vulnerable families. How so?
Well, the Trump administration's budget proposal, the White House budget proposal, introduced, you know, several categories of budget cuts. We're talking about billions of dollars of budget cuts to the U.S. Department for Housing and Urban Development. This would mean severe cutbacks for rental assistance for families that are struggling, for families that have still yet to emerge from the Great Recession. And at a time when an affordability crisis is really taking grips nationally, it could do great harm.
So in the crosshairs are what, Section 8 housing vouchers and the community development block grants?
Those are two of the bigger programs. There's also the home, various public housing operating funds, housing for persons with disabilities, housing for the elderly, project-based rental assistance. Of those, I think that only project-based rental assistance was ever looking to get a significant bump in the White House budget proposal. I should say that the House and Senate versions are less severe, but we have seen over the course of the last 8 years, and in really even further back, just a continued pattern of decline in these housing funding programs.
And remind us, Kristen, if you would, what Section 8 housing vouchers mean to those who are very low income?
So a Section 8 housing voucher, it makes up the difference between a certain portion of the rent and what the market rate actually is. So this is really crucial for low-income families who live in especially hot housing markets in cities largely, and really in cities all over the country. Families that are struggling can make the rent with the assistance of these vouchers. But when the support for voucher programs looks like it is in question, you sometimes see, as we have seen in a lot of cities, landlords lose confidence in the program and take those homes or apartments off the market, maybe consider converting them into a higher market rate apartment building, or just simply withdrawing from the Section 8 program altogether.
And all of this is as the number of homeless people without shelter grew substantially last year?
Yes, it did. The homelessness has been an increasing concern with the affordability crisis. I mean, the United States now has a shortage of 7.2 million rental homes that are affordable to low-income renter households, or really to extremely low-income renter households. So that is a community that is very sensitive to shocks. And some of the administration's proposals that are happening at a time when rents are just generally rising all over the country mean that you can have big swings in the population of people experiencing homelessness.
So what is the rationale from the administration in proposing these cuts?
Well, I'll give an example. The Making Affordable Housing Work Act of 2018, this is a standalone bill that is supported by HUD, would dramatically increase rents for households that receive assistance, and also institute working requirements for adults in those households. The idea is that if you can put people to work, you reduce their need for assistance, as Secretary Ben Carson likes to say, it makes them self-sufficient. However, that doesn't really jive with the numbers or the statistics for people who do receive various kinds of welfare assistance. Most of the people who can work do work. Many of the people who receive aid either are elderly, are disabled, or are caretakers for people who are elderly or disabled, or caretakers for children. So it's extremely hard for some of the most vulnerable families in America to follow a rigid prescription for finding certain kinds of work.
And correct me if I'm wrong, Kristen, but speaking of people who are low income, such as the elderly, this Making Affordable Housing Work legislation or act, I should say, would establish a minimum rent for households which don't have to pay that mandatory 30% toward rent. Is that correct? And what would that mean? In other words, somebody who didn't have to pay that would now have to pay that money as part of the rent, whether they can afford it or not.
Yes, that's right. It does. This bill does establish a minimum basement. So households that are currently exempt from paying the 30% standard that exists now, and these are namely households who are the elderly or disabled, would have to pay a minimum $50. And while that might not sound a lot to listeners, this could be just an enormous shock to really vulnerable households. For a lot of the families who are exempt from the current requirements for something for housing vouchers, they earn less than $2,000 a year. So $50 a month would would be the kind of thing that could really disrupt their life patterns, could make them sacrifice things like food or health care, and could result in an increase in homelessness.
So the clause which asks able-bodied recipients to work to help pay for their housing, I would assume doesn't apply here for seniors and for people who are disabled and can't get into the workplace. Why? What is the rationale here? Have you heard any reasoning for inclusion of this particular part of the Making Affordable Housing Work legislation?
For this, you know, minimum basement, this $50 minimum, I think that the idea from the Department of Housing and Urban Development is to try to shake up the very long waiting lists. But another way of looking at that is to say that you decrease the demand for assistance by cutting off the supply for people who still do require it, putting time limits or setting standards that current recipients cannot meet.
And then they might end up homeless.
They might end up homeless, and they're not less in need for aid by being denied the aid that they were receiving.
So,
I mean,
Oh, go ahead, Kristen.
Well, I do think that there is a very urgent crisis with waiting lists. The number of families eligible for housing aid are not receiving it. Only one in four families who are eligible for the aid are receiving it. But I'm not sure that this prescription actually solves the problem as it just maybe cycles through the families who are getting the help.
So very quickly, what is the reaction from Congress to this?
The reaction has been tepid so far. To my knowledge, unless it's happened this morning, no legislator has stepped forward to introduce this bill. And the same goes for work requirements for Medicaid and food aid. The most serious issue was with food aid, but that bill failed for entirely different political reasons. I don't see that this has the support to pass the Senate, but it does appear to be a strong priority for the Trump administration generally and for the Department of Housing and Urban Development in particular.
So at least for the moment, affordable housing advocates and those who are in affordable housing can breathe a little easier.
They can, but I think that something you see within markets, within housing markets, and that's everywhere, is that landlords see the signal. And landlords who are currently, you know, building developments or considering whether to continue to be a Section 8 apartment or a low-income apartment building might look at this and say and see that things could change in the future, and that uncertainty does have an effect on the marketplace.
Let's get back to a Housing and Urban Development Secretary Ben Carson. He's facing a complaint filed by housing advocates to pressure the government to enforce an Obama-era rule related to the Fair Housing Act of 1968. What does this rule do, and what's the reasoning behind HUD's efforts to suspend it?
The rule is called the Affirmatively Furthering Fair Housing Rule. That clause is part of the Fair Housing Act of 1968. It says that not only may you not discriminate on the basis of race or other protected categories when you are creating housing or renting a unit or things of this nature, but that leaders have an obligation to try to desegregate their communities. As we know, when we look around our communities today, this has not happened. This work has not been done. But after a pivotal Supreme Court decision in 2015, the Obama administration was able to implement a rule that would actually set forth the work. It prescribed an assessment where communities could, using a tool a bit like a calculator, describe their communities and look at what their segregation patterns are and what their housing problems are and what steps they needed to begin to take to address those problems. This tool was only just begun. It had only just begun to be implemented. Mm-hmm. Only several dozen communities had tried this work before Carson suspended the requirements and then suspended the tool altogether.
And again, the reasoning behind the suspension?
The department said that communities had struggled with this tool, that a number of the communities who tried their assessments, those assessments were rejected when they were first introduced. But advocates understood this was always going to be the case. When you're applying a new test to a community or asking a community to look at a problem that it has not faced before, then they might not get everything in on the first time. And the number of failures was very small because the number of rejections was very small because the number of communities that had even attempted this was very small. So it was not tested well enough to be fully considered a burden to communities, but even that burden was always going to be part of the process. It's growth. It's desegregation. This is just an extraordinarily hard
complicated
problem to uproot.
Yeah. Kristen, tell us about an advocacy effort called Home One, and is it effective?
Home One?
Yeah, I believe now maybe this was not an article that you had written. I thought perhaps you had, but it was a group which is actually putting together public service announcements and videos in an effort to forward the affordable housing debate and get it out there. And I just perhaps it's something I'm bringing into the conversation that I should bring into a different conversation.
I'm sorry. I'm afraid I can't speak to it. I'm not sure that I am familiar with that.
Well, then obviously the PSA hasn't gotten to you.
I'll look out for
it. They need
to
get it out a little bit. Yeah, exactly. Get it out a little bit more. You also write that there's growing consensus on what should be done about the housing shortage, easing density restrictions in high opportunity areas near jobs and transits. And we talked about Philadelphia Councilwoman Maria Quinones Sanchez's proposal to allow developers to build denser and taller buildings if they build more affordable housing units. Very quickly, we only have about a minute or so left. There might be arguments against more high density housing, pollution, less green space, et cetera. What are your thoughts on this?
I think inclusionary zoning is important, but I think it's important to remember that it's responsible for very little affordable housing nationwide. So far, inclusionary zoning is a theory more than a practice. I don't think that inclusionary zoning alone can get what we need. We still need simple rent subsidies. We need solutions like public housing. And a way to address the wage gap. Now, those solutions are a bit beyond me, but I do think inclusionary zoning is one part, one tool in the toolbox.
And we do have a tweet asking, what are your thoughts on increasing wages after 40 years of wage suppression to keep up with higher housing prices and rent prices?
That's certainly a problem. I mean, affordable housing is a problem across the rental pattern. It's only people who are making very high incomes who are able to rent in a lot of our high job markets without suffering a cost burden. But how you fix the wage gap is a difficult problem and slightly beyond my scope of expertise, but it is certainly one that fuels the affordable housing crisis today.
All right, Kristen Capps, thanks so much for joining us for Radio Times. It was a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Kristen Capps is staff writer at The Atlantic's City Lab. And as always, why not connect with us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook? Also, take a listen to our podcasts. Just go to whyy.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. Our producers, Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. Thanks so much for joining us, as always, for Radio Times.